Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 124 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, as always, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful sunny Lubbock, Texas. And I'm also the interim chair and program director. And we are always looking for people who want to come practice great medicine and teach wonderful people right here in our lovely community.
You guys hear that, listeners? Michelle is the chair at Texas Tech. Interim chair. But still, don't you want to work with Michelle and the pimping bell, which is sitting right next to her? That sound is the pimping bell, which exists to highlight especially question-worthy content, so pay attention when the pimping bell rings. And listeners, we are very fortunate today. We have a special guest with us. This is Dr. Ian Miles. Ian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have you on the show. Do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Yeah, I'm an allergist immunologist by trade. I work at National Institutes of Infection and Allergy and Infectious Diseases, or NIH, and I've been working on mostly eczema research and how the environment drives that in allergic diseases.
And you were an author on an episode or on an article that we discussed a couple episodes ago in episode 122. To grossly oversimplify your hard work, I would say it talked about how different bacteria, when exposed to different environmental sources, can turn to sort of evil disease potentially causing versions of themselves. So that was definitely an how the environment can affect the development of atopic dermatitis kind of paper.
That's the take home that's necessary, I would say.
And it sounds like you're pretty passionate about this stuff. You've written a book. It's called Gattaca Has Fallen, How Population Genetics Has Failed the Populace. And I mean, that seems like a good place to start. Probably hard to summarize an entire book in the few minutes we have here.
Yeah, it's very long. But I think the opening premise is that with good intentions, a lot of people got into this kind of research believing that they were going to find the gene for eczema the same way that people find the gene for cystic fibrosis. And that has gone from the gene to the genes to the polygenic score to the omnigenic score. And we don't have a single screening tool to show for it. There's not a practitioner out there who sends off their kids' genetics to decide whether they're at risk for atopic derm or which the treatments are best. And it's just, you know, a continual, I would just say, disappointment. Again, well-intentioned at the time. And I think it speaks to a desire to view something wrong with the patient that, it, you know, there's a bunch of kids living on a street, say 20 kids on a street. And here in America, by math, 5 or 6 of them will have atopic derm, but sometimes their siblings won't. And this gets framed as, well, those kids lost the genetic lottery or some kind of intrinsic defect that can only be met with a prescription drug. And so I'm sure all of us have heard patient groups and patients accuse physicians of only being in the pocket of pharma and all we want to do is give medicines. And if you've met physicians, you know, that's not, I'm sure some of them are terrible, but I mean, the general practitioners would love to cure their patients, right? They haven't met a pediatrician who would love to render their patient cured and not have to see them again, despite their caring for them. And I think some of that comes from the idea that if we can't view the disease as anything other than a defect of the patient, then the only solution is some biochemical intervention. And this gets patients frustrated because they feel like all we ever offer are medications when they're really trying to figure out, well, why did my kid get this disease in the first place? Or why am I flaring? Like, why do I flare on Wednesday when I was fine the whole week before, kind of thing? And that's really what got me, you know, interested in looking at the environmental causes.
Would it be a fair summary of part of the argument of the book to say that, in your opinion, our researchers and our scientists have focused on genetics too much and have underemphasized environmental causes, perhaps as a result of our focus on genetics?
Yeah, without any doubt. You know, I'm much more harsh in the book than that summary is. I think that you know, it, what gets attention is when you, if you hear about some researcher who wants to find genes for criminal behavior or going to college or intellect, I think most rational people are a little queasy about being near those people because they're like, ah, what is this guy up to kind of thing. But when somebody does it for asthma or eczema or psoriasis, it doesn't ring those same issues. You know, it doesn't make it as obvious to say, you know, why would we believe, you know, because this folds into the eugenics and bigotry aspects of it. Because if there was a person who said, oh, you know, the reason why Black Americans are incarcerated more than white Americans is some genetic factor that we have yet to discover, most people would recognize that as race science. But there are entire labs predicated on the idea that we're going to go find some gene as to why Black Americans have asthma at higher rates, with very little evaluation on it from those labs as to what are the environmental pollutant exposures, what are the early life exposures. And so as you start to dissect genetics, you see that it's just a fraction of a role statistically, not even interventionally, but just on math, it's creating a very tiny modulation of environmental factors, but that gets all the attention, that gets the funding, that's how you get into Nature Genetics and build your career on that, versus doing a genuine environmental assessment.
I really liked the groundwater approach that you mentioned in that article that we discussed. A brief summary again, probably oversimplified, is that if you find a lake and there's like one or two dead fish floating in the lake, you're like, what's wrong with these fish? But if you come across a lake and there's like a bunch of dead fish, you say, what's wrong with this lake? And I think the argument is that we're now kind of living in the lake because eczema, for example, is so prevalent. And so rather than be examining the people with eczema, we should be examining our lake, which is our environment, to figure out what's wrong with our lake.
Exactly. And, you know, and it I think it adds up, you know, Dr. Matthew Zerwas says it very well. He's a dermatologist. He says, you know, patients come to us looking for answers and instead they get medications. And then when they get frustrated with a side effect or that the medications aren't working or the lack of answers, then they stop trusting the medication. And it very quickly goes, you know, the patients know, they can look around and see that they're in the lake and that, you know, all of these kids are suddenly developing peanut allergy and eczema and asthma. And when it feels like the medical community is saying to them, your kid has a dupilumab deficiency, they know that that's not true. And that doesn't take away from the fact that these drugs can be life-altering and beneficial. I do not discourage anybody from taking a drug that is helping them relieve their symptoms. But it speaks to the idea that kind of need to expand our mindset a little more and look to these potential environmental causes. And this is really on the research community, because I know, you know, the practicing physicians, you know, pediatric and derm and allergy, they would love to be able to give their patients evidence-based answers to the questions like, well, which emollients are best? Are there ingredients that I should avoid in emollients? Do bed sheets even matter for this disease? You know, what are the kinds of things I could do to get the most out of my medicines? I trust you, I'm taking the meds, but I still have flares. What can I do to make better? And we give the practitioners nothing. You know, you have these practice parameters that are mostly about drugs, and understandably so, to inform you, particularly now that, you know, we're having this onslaught of monoclonal antibodies for whatever coming down the pike and JAK inhibitors to help understanding. But then when you look like at the sections that say, what am I supposed to eat, right? It says, we don't have enough information to provide you any guidance on diet. We don't have enough information to provide you any guidance on soaps or lotions or emollient choice or whatever. And you do get a little frustrated from a research standpoint, because you say, how many hundreds of millions of dollars and decades of atopic derm research? I mean, we're talking about a disease that was described in the era in papyrus, dug out of a pyramid. So the idea that we know what this disease is and we've had all of this time, and the collective wisdom of all of biomedical research is, I have no idea what to tell you what to eat beyond try to eat healthier in kind of like a nebulous sense. I can understand patients' frustrations, because I think I share it. And I do get frustrated with it. And I feel like it, you know, the book was really spirited by the idea that this is a way of hiding race science behind otherwise benevolent intentions. And when you have people going out there saying, you know, Black Americans are getting more eczema because there must be some intrinsic defect that we just haven't figured out, that precludes your thinking to go look at those environmental causes, to separate those out and understand that that information would benefit everybody, right? There's no one in America has not been benefited by the realization that lead toxicity was bad, even though it disproportionately fell on marginalized communities, some of whom, you know, not all of whom are minoritized. So those are the kinds of things that I think about a lot when I do our work.
Well, and I think that you're right on the money with the fact that our population is becoming increasingly more sensitized to a toxic environment. And the toxicity of the environment isn't distributed evenly across different populations. So in some ways, you know, we're looking at the person as the nidus of this condition without examining the surrounding elements that impact their gene expression. Like, we know that some of the toxic chemicals that can be present in groundwater in highly industrialized areas alter gene expression, right? So is it the gene expression being altered by the environment, or is it the genes being there? And I think that there's a kind of a conflagration of those things where there's the potential that comes together with the environmental exposure. But you're right that pathologizing the person and treating only the genes is leaving the environment out of the equation, which is not an equitable way to take care of patients.
Exactly. Exactly. Because even if you're going to argue that, you know, even if there was a gene that predisposed a child to adverse effects from leaded gasoline fumes, mm-hmm. the solution is get the lead out of the gasoline, right? Like, mm-hmm. we can have, who cares? You know, I joke that I might have an allele that if I caught Ebola, I would spontaneously combust. Right. But it's not something that I genuinely worry about in my day-to-day mm-hmm. activity, because it's not an exposure I care about. The U.S. could be filled with risk alleles for dysentery, but we don't worry about it because we have a health care, you know, a water infrastructure that protects mm-hmm. us from ever having to concern ourselves with that. And so, you know, I would love to have that same kind of conversation one day about eczema. Mm-hmm. To say, you know, we at NIH, we have monogenic patients who have syndromes which include eczema. This is the Wiskott-Aldridge and the Jobe syndrome, STAT3 deficiency. These are exceedingly rare. Yeah, there's a...
Ding, ding, ding. Where's the pimping bell?
Sorry. I'm just so fascinated by it. I was just in awe. Sorry.
Yeah, CARD-11. Those are another pimping one. This is one of the newer ones in there. You know, but those are syndromic problems that tend to show up in an infectious disease doctor's office, not a dermatology office. And those are super rare. And so you're not going to, quote unquote, cure eczema, because all of, you know, those patients do have a genuine monogenic driver. But, you know, not pre-industrial societies and non-industrial societies today have rates that are 0.5% of kids. And today we're at 15 to 20% in the United States. You know, like I did rotations in for the Ebola vaccine in Liberia. You know, you couldn't find anybody who was anaphylactic to food. And now you can't go to a single elementary school in the United States and not have somebody who, you know, creates a red flag or peanut aware school. And that didn't happen because our genetics shifted in two generations. So I would really like mm-hmm. to see more environmental focus.
One of the things that excited me about your book was that it argues against genetic determinism, which was so refreshing and kind of like freeing, because I feel like, I don't know if it's now or this within the past 10 or 20 years or perhaps longer, people have been talking about, well, your genes really drive what you do. And in fact, there's like arguments out there that free will is an illusion because everything we do is just determined by our genes in one sense or another. And then you read these creepy twin studies that talk about twins that were separated early in life. And they both like raise their pinky when they drink their tea, and they both drink the same tea, and they're both named their children the same names and stuff. And you do have a section of the book where you talk about the flaws in twin studies. Michelle is an identical twin, by the way. I would love to hear you summarize those for our listeners, because that was refreshing and reduced my creepy level significantly.
Twins are inherently creepy, so I get it.
Yeah, the reared apart twin studies that you're mentioning, where, you know, two people married a Susan and both love Mickey Mantle. The flaws with those is the overwhelming majority of those twins knew each other before they were separated. So they may have been in the same household till they were 10, and then they were separated. And yeah, they might have been worlds apart in between, but you know you have a twin somewhere. And that automatically is going to make things a little bit biased. It also doesn't have time controls. So like if you find a 70-year-old who says my favorite baseball player is Mickey Mantle, doesn't surprise you, right? But if you found a 10-year-old who said that, you'd be like, that's weird. If you know, who's your, you've been hanging out with your grandfather kind of thing, right? So there are like these generational differences. And then the other thing is, if you really sat down between any two random people and just went through every possible variable in your life, you'd find things that overlap that don't seem creepy at all. You're like, I also like spaghetti without red sauce or whatever, right? You're like, what does that even mean? If you, it only seems cool when you phrase it like that. The whole construct of twin studies in the beginning, it's predicated on the idea that identical twins experience the environment the exact same way as fraternal twins. So even if they went out the hospital delivery room through different doors, the idea is their environments are basically the same. So the only thing that differs between the groups is the genetics. And we just know that's not true. I mean, I guess, you know, Michelle can speak to, if you are constantly being confused for another human being, even sometimes by your own parents or friends or loved ones, you share an identity. You start to see your, that person is an extension of you in a way that a traditional fraternal twin is not. You also share facial expressions, and, you know, people who misperceive a facial expression will misperceive it in you the same as your twin. And so the environment is just far more intensely shared. And the reason twin studies will not die is because they come up with these ludicrous numbers claiming that things like your cheese preference is 80% genetic, or, you know, whether or not you're Christian is 65% genetic. I love the idea that there's a Christian gene floating around in the genome that somehow was activated only in the last 2000 years and only in a small tribe of Jews in Israel. You know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But this is where these numbers come from. And if you stop that, like if you don't look at twin studies and you look at the actual genetic data for all of these behaviors, like you're talking about 1% explanation, 0.5%, you know, at best, if you squint, they can get it up to 10%, and it just doesn't hold water. It doesn't, you'd be like, well, why are we spending all this money chasing after a cause that is 2% of the overall problem? But with twin studies, they get to claim, well, maybe it's 80% of the overall problem. And this is where eczema was. Eczema is 80% quote unquote heritable. And it pretends that twins would be identical. And in the book, I go through all of these examples of why that data would get thrown off just for eczema, in terms of, well, which pairs of twins are more likely to be forced to wear the exact same clothing on the exact same day, on the exact same part of the
world. How did you know?
Exactly. You know, and then every parent of two kids has had to have the conversation where one kid wants one meal, one kid wants another meal. And it's like, what do I do today? Is this a battle hill I want to die on today and force the other one to eat what they don't want or pick a third food item? Twins are less likely to do that. So they're more likely to eat the same things. They're more likely to be confused for one another. They're more likely to share the same activities. So my favorite, the one that gets bantered around a bunch, is love of sailing was supposed to be 85% genetic. There was going to be a gene for loving sailing. And of course, when you dissect it, you say, if your identical twin wants to go sailing, you want to go sailing with them because you consider yourself an extension of them and you consider yourself a pair in ways that fraternal twins do not. And it's just less expected of each other. And so, you know, that is the foundation upon which everybody went into the field believing that they were going to find 80% of eczema in the genome, because that's what the twin studies told them. Those twin studies were not designed by people whom we would want to hang out with today. They are not designed by anybody who had good intentions of what they were going to use it for, many of whom designed their math explicitly to calculate the inferiority of the Jew. This is their stated intent of their equations. And so now you have to ask the question of, well, if they had an equation that told them something else, if they had an equation that told them men and women are equal and black and white are equal, that equation is in the trash can, right? That is not one that they put into their textbooks. And these are the calculations upon which all these other more ludicrous claims are being based.
It was even worse for Michelle, if I don't misremember Michelle, because she and her twin were actually the same name.
Yes. Yep. Same first name.
I have a chart in the book where I'm trying to make a fake ludicrous example of the heritability of first initials, because identical twins are more likely to be, you know, John and Jack, you know, mm-hmm. they're going to name them that way. And somebody actually said to me, like, that's kind of a silly example. No one would ever worry about their first names. And now I got to go back and maybe I'll edit it to say, what if we name them the exact same thing?
I'll tell you what happens. It messes up both of their credit and causes more problems than you could possibly imagine.
Exactly.
So their names are not both Michelle anymore. They both changed their names. So they're different now.
Michelle is my middle name, but I go by it now. It's now my first name.
So, Ian, we've taken up a lot of your time. I don't want to take up too much more, but I do want to ask you one practical question from a dermatologist perspective. So after this conversation, which I think is pretty convincing, when my patient's parents say, well, why does my kid have eczema? What should I tell them?
Yeah, I would say that it is the totality of research says it's not their fault. It's not something that they did. And anything that they have had control over at the time, we didn't know better to tell them, right? The important thing is to strip away the guilt of the idea. I hear it all the time, like, oh, I had a C-section. Maybe if I didn't, my kid wouldn't have that. Now, C-sections actually haven't panned out that well for eczema. They have for food allergies. But you want to first take away their guilt, right? Like, we did the best we could, and you did the best you could, and now here we are. I would drive the idea that we live in a world where, you know, there are certain toxic exposures, and your kid almost certainly got an unfair amount of it somewhere that was mostly out of your control. It's the same thing. And this is a bad example to give to the patient, but in terms of conceptualizing it for obesity, right? No one would ever ask the question, well, why isn't every American obese if junk food is so bad, right? Because you know, it's an exposure difference. You eat a ton of it, your risk is higher. And so you just tell the parent, hey, your kid got these bad exposures. And now that science is finally catching up to that reality, we are getting closer to telling you what to do. We do have a review article that is being sent out that is just literally how to mitigate these things and to tell patients. This is exactly what we would tell them. We all know the bathing practices, but we threw that in there. But, you know, we have data showing that the bed sheets that you use foster the growth of harmful organisms and manipulate the growth of beneficial organisms. So when you get out of your bed sheets, if you seeded them with Staph aureus, they'll still be there when you get home tonight. And Roseomonas will stop behaving properly while on those bed sheets. Other things, like, we're getting smarter about which air purifiers might be useful. There could obviously be, you know, this is beyond my scope, but like legislative practices in terms of like, what, you know, should we have a label on things? You know, because even products that are labeled green can have certain chemicals in them. And so it'd be nice, you know, as like if you go to the grocery store and it has a hint of peanut in it, it has like, this has peanut in it plastered across the back somewhere. It'd be nice to have something like that to say, you know, the following has this chemical, which could be concerned of people with sensitive skin and stuff like that. So we're getting there. I share... this kind of, like, you know, there's some actionable things that patients can do, but really it needs to be more of a system-wide approach. But I would say, you know, when people ask, you know, well, what causes it, you know, I'd say industrialization. And if you are in the wrong park on the wrong day and you get a big waft of some of this stuff blowing at you, you know, you're going to be at risk. We all had those. Most of us, I think at this point in the country, have had to stay indoors from a massive wildfire, either in Canada or in San Francisco or wherever. I would say the same thing is likely a problem for atopic derm. And if you got lost the quote unquote environmental lottery, which is a horrifying term that they use in the genetic lottery book. But just to say that if you had an unfair exposure, this is where you are. And at least we're starting to get better at how to undo that damage.
We actually reviewed an article about a year ago, I think, on the podcast that looked at flares of atopic dermatitis after wildfires. And the fact that the aryl hydrocarbon receptor is now a therapeutic target, that molecular receptor is probably there because at some point it served a purpose when there would be episodic wildfires that people dealt with, and it probably turned on some genes that helped respond to the stress of that environment. But when it's something that's chronic smoldering activity, like somebody living in an environment where they're exposed to that kind of chemical on a regular basis, you know, that could also drive, you know, genetic expression changes and phenotypic alteration in patients.
Yep, Exactly. Yep. Wildfires. And that was the other part that was creepy when we did our work, is the only natural source of either isocyanate or xylene is wildfires. Again, with a lot of the work around environmental evaluations has used the best databases they have, but those typically are particulate matter or VOCs or whatever, which are blanket categories. And we need to get far smarter as to, like, all right, what, you know, particulate matter is just a size question, right? It is not about the chemical makeup. So now we got to get really smart about dissecting apart those chemicals to figure out which ones are most concerning, and then design filtration systems to match that, design detection systems to match that, so that one day you might be able to have, like, you get this warning in the morning that today's a high ragweed day, just letting you know, right? We're going to warn you. You might have some kind of, like, this is a high eczema chemical day. You might want to preemptively add a little more of your therapies or stay inside or whatever you want to do to protect yourself from these issues.
Well, Ian, we really appreciate you being on here, and I really admire the work that you're doing. I think it doesn't have nearly as much funding as, like, making new drugs, so kudos to you. Once again, Ian's book is called Gattaca Has Fallen, How Population Genetics Failed the Populace. Obviously, you can check that out if you want to learn more about his work. And is there anywhere else people can find out more about you and what you're doing?
I guess PubMed. I don't know. That's in your podcast now.
So. Perfect. Well, thanks so much for being here, Ian. This was super interesting. I'd love to have you on again sometime.
Anytime. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Listeners, I hope you're ready for some continued discussion about environmental factors and some hard-hitting basic science, because that's what's coming up next. I think I was inspired to look into a lot of this basic science stuff, probably from Ian's paper that we talked about a couple episodes ago. So this one in particular was drawn from one of his references. I think I mentioned at the time, air purifiers for eczema. He mentioned in this discussion that the air purifier thing maybe didn't really pan out for eczema stuff, but that, among many other things, came out of this article that we're going to talk about. It's from a journal called Oncotarget from 2017 and is called A Prospective Birth Cohort Study of Different Risk Factors for Development of Allergic Diseases in Offspring of Non-Atopic Parents. This is out of Taiwan, and the authors include Ming Tsung Li and Kuender D. Yang. So I hope that you're convinced, listeners, that environment plays at least a significant role, if not a majority role, in the development of some of these allergic or atopic diseases. So these guys were trying to look into what environmental factors may play a role in these issues. It was a big study. It enrolled 1,500 newborn babies, and then they surveyed their families at various time points regarding diagnoses of atopic dermatitis, allergic rhinitis, and asthma, and then a bunch of questionnaires about the environment in which the children were being raised. So 1,500 newborns at age 3, 1,200 of these kids were still around to be surveyed, and then at age 6, 750 of them. So they lost some, but a fair amount still hung on. I mean, 6 years later to still come back and complete a study is pretty good. So the overall prevalence was 8% for atopic dermatitis. So Ian in particular has commented that ranges from sort of 2 to 20% depending on where you are. This is in Taiwan, so possibly some, I don't know, not as industrialized as the Western world, I presume. Never actually been to Taiwan, but sort of moving in that direction is my understanding. The prevalence of allergic rhinitis was 31% and asthma was 12%. The children of atopic parents were more likely to have allergic rhinitis and asthma, but for atopic dermatitis, it didn't really seem to matter if your parents were atopic or not. Increasing the risk for atopic dermatitis was breastfeeding.
Huh?
Say what? Talk more about that in a second. And also C-section, just like Ian just mentioned. So the odds ratio that you would have atopic dermatitis if you were both breastfed and born via C-section was 3, meaning you were 3 times more likely to have eczema, basically, if you were breastfed and born via C-section versus if you were not either of those things. So I was surprised about this breastfeeding thing. I thought that breastfeeding was supposed to be, like, protective against allergic diseases. Michelle, you're married to an allergist. Does he have opinions about breastfeeding?
I mean, I think the general, like, medical advice has been for a very long time that breastfeeding is theoretically protective against a lot of things. So, you know, I think that it's always good to look at things that we just accept as dogma and challenge them to make sure that we're not operating with faulty information or information that's become outdated. And we do also know that certain environmental contaminants make their way into breast milk, and some of them even concentrate there. So there is the possibility that that could play a role in this.
Maybe the reason that eczema is so much more common now is because in the 60s, all the babies were fed formula, and now we're back to breastfeeding again. And so this breastfeeding stuff does kind of go against common wisdom. And I will say, I haven't read a ton about breastfeeding, but it seems like it's a pretty good idea. Having had two kids myself and seen breastfeeding stuff happen, like, it's often just not a picnic. It's not like it shows in the movies and the pictures when it's sweet, healthy baby, sweet, healthy mom, everyone's happy and just doing their thing. It can be more involved than that. So I'd judgment-free area, whatever you choose to feed your baby, as long as it's nutritious, is a fine choice. I don't think increasing the risk of atopic dermatitis is enough to counter the other positive effects of breastfeeding, certainly. But this increase in atopic dermatitis risk is concordant with some other recent studies. So these guys cite a 2004 study from Denmark that showed that breastfeeding doesn't protect against allergic diseases, and it was associated with an increased risk of atopic dermatitis, as well as a 2008 study from Japan that found that it wasn't protective against asthma, and a 2005 study from New Zealand that showed that breastfeeding was correlated with an increased risk of atopic dermatitis. So there are certainly data that argue this.
And there's evidence that things like polychlorinated biphenyls, DDT and its metabolites, dioxins, dibenzofurans, heavy metals like cadmium, lead, and mercury have all been demonstrated in human breast milk.
That's terrifying. And since you mentioned cadmium, after we signed off with Ian, we just chatted with him for a few more minutes, and he mentioned that cadmium is one that's been associated with autism. Freaking terrifying. Mm-hmm. You know, this makes this whole issue a lot more complicated, because I feel like I used to be able to say, well, I tried to at least say that the pathogenesis of atopic dermatitis was really complicated. And if you looked it up in a textbook, you find a gigantic list of things. And probably the answer is that some of those things are more important in some people than others. But basically, it's bad luck. And the genes and the environment both play a role, which I think is still sort of fair. But just like Ian said, you don't want people to feel bad, like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have been eating processed foods when I was breastfeeding my child when they were an infant. Like, man, right. It's a tough spot.
Mom guilt is real, dude. Like, you know, the challenges that modern mothers face trying to balance all the expectations that are kind of impressed upon them. And then we add environmental contaminants into the equation and trying to find something that's just safe and healthy for your baby. That's really challenging. I mean, the formula question, a lot of formula is made with tap water, right? So if you have contaminated tap water and you're making powdered formula mix into food for your baby, that's still a potential source of contamination as well. It's rough.
I'm not a mom, so I can't speak to mom guilt, but I can also tell you that dad guilt is real as well. I cannot compare the two directly. And I suppose as long as we're talking about it, I don't know that we should hate on industrialization too much. It's done a lot of good for the world, too. But I do think that we should do a better job of understanding the risks that come along with this stuff.
Yeah.
But back to this article. Also correlated with an increased risk of atopic dermatitis was if one of your family members smoked.
Okay.
And if your flooring was made of tiles. Tile flooring.
Interesting.
And I don't know how much we as dermatologists, you know, care that much about asthma and allergic rhinitis, but for what it's worth, curtains were bad for allergic rhinitis, and air purifiers were good for everything. Though in atopic dermatitis specifically, they were good, but not significantly good. So whether or not they're, you know, good for some people on occasion or mildly good, but not enough to move the needle is a little bit tough to say. They're at least easy. I think we mentioned this, again, a couple episodes ago, that humidifiers have some problems and they have to be cleaned and stuff. But air purifiers, I think, are just sort of a turn it on and forget about it kind of device. And they're not super cheap. They're like $200, but it's not too bad. I think, you know, compared to a shot of dupilumab, which is like $3,000 or $1,500 or something, air purifier is pretty cheap. Preterm delivery. What do you think, Michelle? Would this be good, bad, or neutral for these atopic diseases?
Ooh. Conventional wisdom would suggest it would be more likely to induce atopic dermatitis, but I bet we could be surprised. What is it?
It was protective against all three
protective
diseases.
Protective! Oh my goodness. Well, I mean, the environment the baby's in, if they're preterm and you're kept in the NICU, is basically sterile. That's interesting.
Maybe. They argue actually for the opposite, or their hypothesis is kind of the opposite. Maybe you were colonized with maternal flora or other organisms even earlier than you would be if you were born at term, and so you were perhaps have these, quote, good bacteria on you that can protect you. And while it was protective against all three diseases, that was only significant specifically for allergic rhinitis. The authors postulate that perhaps that's because it was the most prevalent, so perhaps if you had a larger sample size, it would have been discovered to be significant for occasional patients with the other diseases. So based on all of this, the authors postulate, and I don't know how Ian Miles would feel about this, that children from non-atopic parents may be influenced more by the environment because they don't have the presumed genetic markers that can potentially influence this. So they're more at risk for environmental exposures, especially, they say, microbiota. A couple caveats. This was all out of Taiwan, so whether or not it's generalizable to some of the rest of the world is, you know, questionable. Taiwan's, again, I've never been there, but it's subtropical, for example, and it's got other, you know, cultural and geographic factors that I'm not sure are necessarily generalizable elsewhere, but still, I think useful information. They do note that atopic dermatitis seems to be a bit different from allergic rhinitis and asthma in terms of its inheritance and its environmental risk factors. So, well, they do all tend to march along, as we say. They maybe not quite as related as we think they are sometimes.
Taiwan does have relatively significant air pollution in at least parts of the country. I've been able to visit one time to watch my sister perform an opera there, actually. It was quite nice. But the population density does create, at least in the urban centers, quite a lot of air quality issues. Like you can actually see the haziness in places. And I do wonder if that also kind of changes the expression of some of these conditions. The environmental piece of atopy, I think, is the next frontier that really needs to be explored. And it's hard because environmental studies involve complex exposures. So doing research on that kind of thing is complicated, but important.
Plus, it seems like there's a whole bunch of environmental factors, all of which like push you, you know, a tiny to a little bit to possibly a medium amount toward the disease state. But nothing's like the huge smoking gun that's really causing it in terms of eczema from the research I've seen, for example. And I assume the truth that that's probably true for a lot of other diseases as well. It's kind of like there's not a there's a few diseases out there that are monogenic, right? Like cystic fibrosis. There's probably occasional diseases that are mono environment, if you will, but probably not many of them. So trying to like get you in the environment to like reduce all that stuff in the modern world is probably a tough sell. But I think still valuable work that we should be doing. And as long as you mentioned like seeing air pollution, we should probably also acknowledge that at least in some parts of the world, it's probably gotten better. Like, I've talked to old timers here in Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City, by the way, is in a valley in the mountains, and sometimes the air kind of gets stuck in here and it gets quite hazy. We call it an inversion. It's sort of a meteorologic phenomenon plus the air pollution that we create. So sometimes we have pretty bad air quality here, but I talked to people who lived here back in like the 50s and 60s, and everyone was, you know, had wood fires in their fireplaces and stuff. And they're like, oh, this is way better than it used to be. And the incidence of eczema was much less back then. Questions. So maybe we're getting better as, at least in the United States, perhaps as we become wealthier slash pay more attention to it slash develop better technologies. And I apologize if this is too much of a tangent, but I have also heard arguments that, well, we're getting better, but just at the expense of everybody else, because we kind of offshore some of these polluting activities to some other countries. And so while there's not as many smokestacks in the U.S., now there's more elsewhere. And so the world is still suffering a similar amount. I guess I don't know the answer to that, but as humanity, we should pay attention to some of this stuff.
Definitely. I think the points that got raised earlier when we were discussing environment also are often going to be dependent upon where a person lives, and sometimes infrastructural elements that are in this modern age somewhat necessary, unless we make other innovations around them to sustain population density that we have and provide energy for the needs of the current populace, those are often distributed inequitably and placed in the communities with the fewest resources to fight against that kind of offloading of pollutants. So you're exactly right that as a country, sometimes we do that to other nations. Even within our own country, we do that within certain populations. One of the good examples would be the oil pipelines going through land that belongs to Native American populations. And the very, I think, noble efforts to stop that, that were just unfortunately still not successful for the prevention of the pipelines going through Native lands and potentially contaminating groundwater for those patients.
Well, this has been an unusual episode of Dermosphere thus far. Let's talk about surgical site infections.
Let's talk about something we have control over in some way. I think that's a good idea. Some control, at least some control. So this is a cool article. It's kind of iconoclastic. I do love an iconoclastic article where it's going to try to turn something that we accept as dogma on its ear a little bit. So this is an article out of the American Society for Dermatologic Surgery Journal, and it is from chief authors Joshua Schimmel and Ashley Decker out of the University of, the Cooper Medical School of Rouen University in Camden, New Jersey, and the Cooper Center for Dermatologic Surgery in Eversham, New Jersey. So that's a very, very nice group of people. The purpose of this study was to look at the surgical site infection rate of second intention wounds after derm surgery and kind of challenge the current dogma in dermatologic surgery that wounds healed by second intention have lower infection rates. And I think that some of that dogma may come from traditional practice around things that are contaminated wounds like dog bites. So I think we all learned in medical school, if somebody comes in with a dog bite, generally you don't close that wound immediately. Now, there are always exceptions to these things, and people have also been looking at that dogma. But when we're talking about a dermatologic surgery, generally these are clean wounds on non-infected skin. We try very hard as dermatologic surgeons not to operate on infected skin sites because of the likelihood of poor outcomes. So there is this dogma in our general zeitgeist, in the dermosphere, if you will, that wounds healed by second intention have lower infection rates. So they wanted to determine the rate of surgical site infection and associated pathogenic organisms of second intention wounds compared with sutured wounds after skin cancer extirpation. To do this, they did a retrospective cohort study of patients who'd had Mohs surgery or wide local excision for skin cancer between 2012 and 2016 at a single site. And they looked at the infection rates across all locations as well as closure types. The overall infection rate was 3.9%, with sutured wounds having a rate of 3.2% and second intention wounds having a rate of 6.8%. And that was a significant difference. The risk of infection for second intention wounds was higher compared to sutured wounds with an odds ratio of 2.22 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.63 to 2.99. So at least doubling of infection rate in this study for wounds that were left to heal by secondary intention. Now, this wasn't distributed evenly across the entire body. The lower extremity had the highest overall infection rate of 10.5%. The face had the lowest overall infection rate of 2.5%. So the conclusion of this study was that for Mohs surgery and wide local excision or surgeries on a lower extremity that was healing by secondary intention, you might have an increased risk of surgical site infection. So the worst sites for surgical site infection with second intention healing actually were the scalp and the legs. And the legs actually had about a doubling or tripling almost of, no, sorry, about a doubling of infection rate. So the infection rate for sutured wounds on the lower extremity in this study was 5.9, and for open or secondary intention wounds, it was 11.8. For scalp, which this kind of makes sense because of the kind of geographic complexity of a scalp and sort of the difficulty in really exhaustively cleaning that surface because there is so much topography to it, that does make sense. And also potentially the inclusion or accidental inclusion of hairs into the closure, which is a good argument for very conservative hair trimming. I'm not saying that you give somebody like a buzz cut for their whole head, but trimming the hairs around the area of surgery, I think, results in fewer complications than trying to valiantly soldier along with all of the patient's hair still in the way. So the scalp infection rates for sutured wounds were 3.5% versus 9.5% for wounds that healed by secondary intention. And so the infection rate in derm surgery, including focal excision in Mohs, ranges from 0.7 to 4.2%. This low infection rate is typically attributed to the fast and non-invasive nature of dermatologic surgery compared to other types of surgery. Anatomic locations may change the risk for surgical site infection. The highest rate of infection after surgery has been reported in the literature to be head, specifically around the ear, lips, or nose, which are areas that have higher concentrations of bacteria naturally, as well as the groin and lower legs, which I think makes sense. There has been a somewhat of a lack of objective data to look at the risk of surgical site infection in secondary intention healing. There was a 2003 longitudinal study by Lawson and colleagues that wasn't looking at skin surgery. It was looking at second intention healing in 5,000 plus patients with post-op wounds following interventions with either trauma, transplant, general surgery, or more invasive things. And their infection rate in that study was 1.2%. So there have not been very many studies looking at rates in second intention healing in dermatologic surgery. Most of them are less than 150 patients, or they're limited by anatomic location. So there's not really good stratification by location. So the purpose of the study was to look at the rate of surgical site infection associated with secondary intention, as well as look at the associated pathogenic organisms for second intention wounds compared to sutured wounds, especially closures which are like flaps, grafts, and skin cancer reconstructions. The definition of second intention wounds for the purposes of this study would be those lacking complete skin closure. Other closures, such as primary closures, flaps, and grafts, were classified as sutured wounds. So the overall second intention wounds were associated with significantly higher risk of infection compared to the sutured wounds. The lower extremity had the highest risk overall. The types of organisms differed between sutured and open wounds. The Staphylococcus species were most common in both types, but they were found in 35% of second intention infected wounds versus 81% of sutured wounds. So significantly more Staph aureus in sutured wounds. When you looked at secondary intention healing, the Pseudomonas species were the second most common, affecting about 10% of those infected wounds. And the Staph aureus was the primary one for sutured wounds, followed by diphtheroids and Klebsiella. So different organisms based off of the closure. The surgical site, the location, had a significant impact on the risk of infection with both sutured and open healing. The reason that we care about surgical site infection is that it impacts wound healing, can create more significant scarring, and has an impact on patient satisfaction. So making the decision between the closure location, the type of closure you're going to use, and the pathogenic organisms you may be dealing with, I think are very important variables for people to take into consideration. The scalp and the lower extremity had the highest rates of infection with secondary intention closing. And there is not a lot of literature analyzing the characteristics of surgical site infection based off of anatomic location, especially for second intention healing. The I think prophylactic studies that they looked at, potentially having the patient do a decolonization protocol prior to surgeries on high-risk wounds. So large surgeries planned for the lower extremity may actually be prudent. There's some data that shows that that might actually be helpful. Staff decolonizing strategies, prophylactic washes, or specific antibiotics may potentially help reduce the risk of infection with second intention wound healing. Now, important to acknowledge that chronic wounds can be colonized by specific bacteria. They can be colonized by staph or pseudomonas. Those are common in chronic wounds. In this study, the closures and the follow-up studies were all less than 3 months of existence of the wound. So it was less likely that this was just colonization, and the only wounds that were cultured had clinical signs of infection: erythema, increased skin temperature, and drainage. The regional differences in flora may help educate your decision as to how to close the patient. I think that most of us, when we're determining how we're going to close a wound that we've made or one that we're confronted with that was made elsewhere, have to take into consideration the patient's individual characteristics. Does the patient smoke? That might limit certain kinds of repairs that you might do. Those metabolically demanding closures, like a skin graft, would be much less likely to be successful in a patient who had compromised circulation from something like cigarette smoking or severe peripheral vascular disease. We also have to take in consideration the like location of the wound. Lower extremities kind of get the wash down from the groin. So the groin is one of our highest sites of bacterial colonization on the body. The nose, of course, and mouth are also high levels of bacterial colonization. But as most people shower, they're showering up, standing up. And so when you're doing that, the bacteria that live in the groin can kind of wash down the legs and, you know, anything sort of south of the groin area may be at a higher risk also because of circulation differences in the lower extremity versus the upper extremity. And the authors also point to potentially different habits around hygiene. We wash our hands multiple times a day, but we very rarely would like wash our feet and legs. So there's the possibility that we have different hygiene practices as well. So I think that this does a nice job of illustrating that second intention healing can have a higher risk for infection. Those patients need to have a appropriate assessment of their risk and risk mitigation as much as possible, potentially with antimicrobial washes and careful dressing changes, and then a low threshold for checking with like culture to determine if the patient might need some kind of antibiotic coverage during the healing process.
Distal legs also just take a longer time to heal, so maybe they have more time that they could get exposed to some bacteria.
That's true.
How useful is a culture?
That makes a very big difference. And they kind of touch on that in this article as well. So if you just pan cultured every single wound that walked through your door, you would get a lot of irrelevant positives because many wounds are just colonized with bacteria. Certain bacterial presence, especially in high numbers, would be more indicative of an active infection. But unless that's connected to the clinical piece, it's not as valuable of a data point. So unless you are perceiving clinical signs of infection, you know, significant wound edge erythema, significant drainage, elevated temperature of the area, you may be getting information that is both true and not relevant. So yes, there are bacteria there, but they're not doing anything bad. We know that a lot of us carry staph around in our nose all the time, but we only notice it when we have like a cold and we are abrading the area and the bacteria have some place to get into. And then we start getting sore places inside our nose or something like that. And then, you know, you need to do some decolonization. But most of us happily coexist with those bacteria 95% of the time. So just having bacteria present on a culture doesn't immediately mean that the thing is infected. And I think that they did a good job in this study of only checking by culture those wounds that had signs of infection.
Yeah, I think culture doesn't convince me that something is infected, but if I think it's infected, then the culture can help drive your choice of antibiotic or, you know, probably you've already put them on some kind of antibiotic, so you can make sure that the bacteria that you find is going to be susceptible to it. A potential limitation, it looks like this study was done on all patients who were treated by a single dermatologic
surgeon.
Single
dermatologist, yeah. I did notice that. I also noticed, gosh, this person is productive because they had like 5,600 something surgeries in, I think it was like a 4 or 5 year period. Yeah. So it was around 1,000 surgical cases a year, which is very nice, robust practice. You know, I think that your technique definitely influences your surgical site infection risk. If you're gentle with the wound edges, you're careful to preserve the microcirculation at the most vulnerable point, which is where the epidermis is breached, the skin heals faster with less scarring and there's less risk for infection. If your surgical technique is pristine versus if your surgical technique is kind of sloppy, you have the different potential for introduction of bacteria into the wound. And, you know, some places also will use different suture types, and we know different suture types carry different risks for bacterial colonization or infection of the wound, braided versus monofilament, how fast they absorb, whether they elicit an inflammatory response. All of these things can play a role with the wound infection risk. And many surgeons are kind of creatures of habit and tend to use similar sutures for similar types of cases. And so there may be some interoperator variability that this study wasn't able to capture because it was just a single surgeon's outcomes. But I do think that the data is fairly convincing that there is some elevation of risk, which makes sense, you know, I think if you really stop and think about it. And just doing proper patient counseling, especially discussing wound care, optimizing for a clean, healthy, well-moisturized, well-vascularized wound is the best strategy.
Well, that's probably all the time we have today, guys. We spent a lot of time today talking to Dr. Ian Miles. Let's recall that he taught us about the importance of environment and argued against genetic determinism. In sort of a similar vein, we talked about some risk factors for atopy, especially atopic dermatitis, breastfeeding, and C-sections. It turns out are associated, and then it looks like closing your wounds or allowing them to granulate by second intention probably increases their risk of infection, and so does a wound on the lower leg. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today, everybody. And thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. And thanks, as always, to all of the members of Team Dermosphere, our enthusiastic group of medical students who keep things moving along behind the scenes. Thank you to Morgan Dykeman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, Lara Dela Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, Nicole Babkowski, Lior Lavin, and Justin Lyon. Among other things, they keep our social media accounts moving along. You can find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also find some video content on YouTube and also a platform called ViewMedi, V-U-M-E-D-I. You've got to make an account for that one, but there's lots of great medical video content on there. Friends, if you feel that we have given you some value and you would like to give some value back to us, you could do so monetarily. You're welcome to donate to the show. There's lots of things we could do with money. There will be a link in the show notes. There will also be a link in the show notes about the University of Utah Dermatology Echo Sessions, which take place the second Friday of every month. It's a great time to come hang out and earn some free CME. And if you would like to hang out with me and Michelle in San Diego this upcoming March, you can find us at the AAD. We'll both be there. In fact, we're both hosting this Resident Jeopardy experience. Michelle, tell us more about that.
That's going to be a lot of fun. So every year at the AAD for the past at least 5 years I've been doing it, it's probably, I think it predated me, but there have been some very spirited competitive moments between different residency programs in Resident Jeopardy, which functions exactly like the television show. So you have to answer in the form of a question and buzz in to get your answer. But the teams of residents apply and then compete with each other. And the, you know, lightning rounds at the end tend to be the most exciting. So we're excited to participate with that.
That's going to be on Saturday afternoon at the AAD meeting. And also, I think you and I are both speaking at the Conquer the Boards section the day prior. Are you going to have given any other talks, Michelle? Anything we should come see you about?
I've got a couple of other ones. I'm doing dermoscopy for the non-dermoscopist. So that is a talk that's given every year at the AAD that has grown over time and has always had really good participation and attendance. And we've really appreciated everybody's participation in that. So that is on the 9th, which is Saturday in the afternoon. And then I'm also doing What's New in Dermatopathology that same afternoon. On Friday, we're going to talk about infectious diseases. So that's Dr. Ted Rosen's session in the morning. And then intermediate dermoscopy on Monday, going over things a little bit more advanced level for dermoscopy. And then finally, a clinical pathologic self-assessment on Sunday in the afternoon. So it's going to be a busy meeting, but we're very excited to get to be there. And we hope we get to see some of y'all. We'll have to bring some Dermosphere swag. We've got some fun pins and buttons and all the other kinds of things. So if you see us running around and would like some Dermosphere swag, just let us know. And we really appreciate everyone listening and participating. It makes this so much fun to do.
Yes, and we'll see you back in your headphones in 2 weeks. See you then.